This is the Bama Podcast with Marty Solomon. I'm his co-host, Brent Billings. Today, we are looking at the under-addressed book called Song of Songs and exploring the ramifications of avoiding the topic of sexuality.
Yeah, sexuality. No presentation today.
I appreciate that.
Oh, man. Yeah, so Song of Songs. All right, I got some notes for me. Interesting topic today, so yeah, I'm just gonna dive right in. Song of Songs. I've been working through the wisdom literature, and we have one more book to discuss. I should mention, I call this wisdom literature from a Jewish perspective. It's not like they don't identify wisdom literature. They definitely see a wisdom tradition. I'm not sure they would put this book in there, but they don't have a section of the scriptures that they call wisdom literature. So I'm doing that for, I know when I was raised in Protestant Christian upbringing, studying the scriptures, I know we had a way of talking about wisdom literature. I'm doing it more for the purposes of my teaching and the fact that most of my audience is definitely Protestant Christian. So that's kind of why I'm doing it. Song of Songs ends up in the, we've talked about the Ketuvim. Can you remember what that meant, Brent?
The writings,
right? Yeah. So we had the Torah, books of Moses. We had the Nevi'im, which was the
prophets.
And then we had the Ketuvim, which is the writings. Song of Songs definitely ends up in the Ketuvim. It's a part of what's called Chamesh Migalot, the five scrolls. And there's three different sections to the writing. The first one is the poetic books, books of poetry, Psalms, Proverbs, and Job, I believe. Now, I'm going to flip right over here and check that before I give anybody false information. Yeah, Psalms, Proverbs, Job. And then Chamesh Migalot includes Song of Songs, Book of Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Book of Esther. So even the Chamesh Migalot puts this in the same section as like Ecclesiastes. So there's some wisdom literature in there. The other books of the Ketuvim end up being Daniel and Nehemiah and Chronicles. They're kind of outliers. They sit in their own section, if you will. So as we're talking, let me just give it that disclaimer. We've been working through the wisdom literature. We've got one more book to discuss before we turn our sights towards the prophets. We've been discussing the idea that throughout the period of history, where Israel struggled with a cycle of redemption, our theme for the book of Judges. During this period, and even going into the Kings, Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, like during this whole period as Israel is struggling to walk the path, applying it to our lives during our periods of struggle as we try to walk the path, I suggested that God provides us with tools. And that's kind of how I like to teach the wisdom literature. There's a handful of books here written during this period, written by some of the kings, written by David, Solomon, collected by Solomon, written by maybe others, who knows. And there's a collection of writings here that serve as tools that we're going to need. We're going to need these tools with us on the journey if we're going to make it through the struggle that you and I know as life. And so we talked about Psalms because we said we're going to need to sing. If we're going to make it through this struggle, if we're going to make it through the daily slog, we're going to need songs. We're going to need to sing. And then we're going to need some wisdom. And so we talked about, what do we call Proverbs, Brent?
Wise sayings that are generally true.
Wise sayings generally true. WSGT, shorthand. Yeah, these are these wise sayings that are generally true. So we're going to need songs. We're going to need wisdom if we're going to make it through this journey. We're going to need some daily nuggets of goodness, if you will. And we're going to need purpose. And so we looked at the book of Ecclesiastes, and we said that Ecclesiastes was all about meaning in life. But there's one more tool that we're going to need if we're going to make it, if we're going to somehow make it down this path that's hard, and sometimes it's rewarding and sometimes it's not, and just that path that we know as life, we're going to also need relationships. Now, this book is going to focus on sexuality. I don't want to give the implication that what I'm saying here is we're going to need romantic relationships. There's an amazing call for a lot of single people out there. And the church has done enough to give the implication that if you're not married, you're not whole, or you're not enough, or you're not complete. And the scriptures are quite adamant, early Christian teaching, very adamant, that there is a special gift, the gift of celibacy, if you will. And that's not just for monks, although that's amazing. It's not just for priests, although that's amazing. There's a lot of people, just general, average people, that God has called to a different kind of experience. Now, most of us have had different experiences or are headed towards different experiences. But I don't want to insinuate that in order to make it in this life, you're going to need to find a spouse. That is certainly not at all on any level what I would ever want to communicate. In fact, Paul might suggest something quite a bit different, which is this: the whole thing gets a lot more complicated when you get married. It's not to say that marriage is bad, not at all. But every situation has its blessings and has its struggles. So, without a doubt. So we have Song of Songs to talk to us about relationships. And this always ends up being a really good discussion, especially for college students in particular. Song of Songs is a biblical piece of literature that's loaded with sexually charged language. There have been many attempts to trivialize the language and make the book into a metaphor that expresses God's relationship with his people. And I'm not totally against that. I mean, obviously, we could go back to our podcast and where he talked about the wedding at Mount Sinai. Song of Songs could definitely, in the background, be used to talk about the relationship between God and his people. A lot of the Jews do that throughout rabbinical teaching. Nothing incorrect about that. But to ignore the primary purpose of the letter, which is this sexually charged erotic poetry, is to do a huge disservice, I believe, to the body of Christ and readers of the scriptures. So let me unpack a little bit what I mean by that. Here's one of the things I mean. There is a place to discuss and appreciate discussion about the beauty of sexuality within its appropriate context. There is a place to discuss and appreciate discussion about the beauty of sexuality within its appropriate context. I have a passion for this topic because I believe the church just does not talk, has not for quite a while, does not today. We don't talk about sexuality well. And when we do talk about it, we talk about sexuality as a moral code. I mean, when we talk about sexuality, it's about all the things you are supposed to do. And pretty much mostly it's about all the things you're not supposed to do and what's okay and what's not okay. And I have never heard a single teaching from anybody, and I'm even going to recommend a few teachings here in just a moment, but I've never heard a sermon series on applying the way of Jesus to the bedroom, the marital bedroom. I've never heard a series on selflessness and the selflessness of marital sex. We've never ever sat back and talked about, we've just talked about what is okay. Is sex okay? Is this kind of sex okay? Is that kind of sex okay? It's always a morality discussion. And it's no wonder that we have such a dysfunctional ability to lead our culture in issues of sexuality, to impact our culture and issues of sexuality, because we don't know, quite frankly, what to do with our sexuality. The topic is viewed largely as off limits and is therefore an untouched oasis of misunderstanding. I like that line. I wrote that a while ago. An untouched oasis of misunderstanding. Man, who wrote that?
That's pretty good.
Man, my goodness. We have so much skewed understanding in the realm of Christian sexuality. I'm not even sure we even know where to begin. I know just over a year ago, it would have probably been 2 or 3 years ago now. I wrote it's probably even longer than that. I'm getting old. But when I first moved up here, yeah, it had to have been more like 6 years ago now that I think about it. It was my first 2 years in campus ministry. I was so struck by the amount of sexuality conversation that I was having with students and the lack of anywhere to go in the church to have that conversation, that I wrote. It was going to be an 8-part blog series. I actually had to stop. I stopped for 4 parts in and just really didn't feel like I was the authority or something was off. And I still haven't felt like necessarily to this day have the green light to that God has given me the nudge that it's okay. I just don't feel something's off. I'm not sure what it is. And so I'm going to be actually reading for our discussion groups. I'm going to be reading those posts. So a little teaser for those that come to discussion group. I'm going to read those posts aloud for the people that attend. I feel like that's a safe space. I'm not going to read them on the podcast. And maybe that's hypocritical of me. I just got done talking about how we don't talk about it. And I want to talk about it a little bit here. I want to be honest. That's part of the problem. We're not honest. We're not honest about this stuff. But I'm not sure how honest I want to be and how much of a public forum. So I won't be sharing those blog posts here. This is a topic that we've proven. People lose their jobs over. That's unfortunate. That's actually part of the problem. It's a major part of the problem. Pastors can't. We can't learn about this. We can't wrestle with this. We can't talk about it, because if we do, and if we happen to say the wrong thing, we lose our jobs. We all know it. And it's charged politically. It's charged morally. And it's only getting worse. The less we talk about it, the worse it becomes. But obviously I'm ranting, so I'm going to, let me move on. To avoid a rant, let me just say that we need to discuss healthy sexuality more within the Christian discussion. Song of Songs proves it. If we need proof, this is the book. Hand the book to any married couple who has been married for at least a few years, and they'll tell you that the book is just full of sexually charged poetry. Young Jewish boys were not even allowed to read this book until I believe they had their bar mitzvah and were of marital age. That's how sexually charged this book was, and all the Jews knew it. And so young boys, this was one book that they were not allowed to read and memorize until later. It wasn't even a part of the canon until later. But
it's a pretty short book, so...
It is.
You've got plenty of other stuff to memorize in the meantime. You can just sneak that one right at the end.
We'll tack that on in at the end. Yeah. Yeah. So it's the descriptions that you'll find in this book, the descriptions that the lovers give to their beloved's body, barring some cultural barriers, like your teeth are like shorn sheep descending upon Mount Gilead. It's a little hard to make that resonate in our world.
Unless you're a sheep farmer.
Maybe unless you're a sheep farmer. I don't know. My wife has never, the lights have never come on for my wife when I've told her that her teeth are like newly shorn sheep.
I don't know very many people who grew up around sheep, so it's hard to say.
So barring some cultural barriers, their descriptions of their beloved's body will make any reader blush. It's not hard to understand what the bride is talking about when she describes, quote, opening the gate, unquote, or letting her lover into her garden. This is absolutely steamy stuff. There's just parts of the book that are explicitly talking about different sexual acts, and anybody reading that honestly sees that as they read Song of Songs. Now, I'm sure that some of you might even be a little uneasy with the fact that I just talked about, quote, opening the gate and letting her lover into her garden when I read those last two sentences, which is actually my point. That's actually the problem. It's in the book, and we get to read it as we look at Song of Songs. But the fact that these topics are off limits, I often tell my college students, one of the other dysfunctions that we have is when we think about, there's that funky conversation when you're an adolescent and you have parents, and the conversation ever starts to go towards your parents' sexuality, marital sexuality. And it's like, there's this automatic response that culture teaches us, oh my gosh, I don't want to hear this. Mom and dad, don't talk about it. And I always love to bring that up with my college students going, now, wait a minute. Don't you hope that your parents, if they're married, have a thriving, vibrant, sexual, married life? Like, I would imagine that would be, if it were me, and I cared about the wholeness and the thriving of my parents, and they were married, I would hope that my parents, be them in their 40s, 50s, whatever, would be parents that had a sexuality that was vibrant and alive and practiced. But of course, we don't want to talk about it. We want to act like it doesn't. This is not going to breed functional sexuality. We have an interesting cultural problem. So if we continue to act like we're not allowed to discuss sexuality, it's craziness. There is a healthy, appropriate sexuality. Healthy sexuality is to be celebrated as much as healthy eating, healthy psychology, healthy spirituality. In fact, healthy sexuality is a part of healthy spirituality and psychology, and vice versa. We are holistic beings. Our sexuality is a part of who we are. Our sexuality is something that it doesn't sit over in its own category. It's not kind of, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. I am a mental, intellectual being. I am a spiritual being. I am a physical being. I am a sexual being. Not just if I'm married. Every human being is a sexual being. Marital relationships get to experience that in a particular way. But we are all, as human beings, part of us has a sexuality. To act like that doesn't exist, or at least to not address it, is not going to be a holistic approach to discipleship. And so as a campus minister, it has to be a regular part of my conversations with students, obviously, particularly men. But even in group settings, this is a large part of our conversation because it's undeniably a part of our human experience. So I'm gonna recommend a couple books here. If you wanted to read more about that idea, about us being sexual beings, I'm going to recommend a book, Sex God by Rob Bell. I know some people, the rest of my talk here, I'm actually going to pull from a Pneuma that Rob also did. So we'll wrap up our podcast here with just a few thoughts, about the different kinds of Hebrew love. That conversation actually comes from a Pneuma video that I watched years and years and years ago, from Rob, called Flame. So we will put that in the show notes as well. Now, some people might be, you know, I mean, Rob Bell's kind of a polarizing figure anyway. And some might be thinking, golly, he's like the worst person to go to. The worst for your sexuality resources. To which I'm like, I disagree, but nevertheless. Great, so who else is talking about it? Who else is talking about sexuality in a way that's not about morality? You know, I read Driscoll's book, not a fan. There's not a whole lot of works out there. There's not a whole lot of works out there that are saying this is what healthy sexuality looks like. This is where sexuality comes from. There are some specialized books about different issues, but we're not having this conversation. So I don't have a whole lot of options to recommend. So if we don't like it, somebody ought to do something about that.
Well, I've seen that Pneuma video, and I do like it.
It is good. Yeah, absolutely. And that's from like years and years and years ago when people still thought he was not a heretic. So.
Yeah, I think I saw it probably in like 2004 or something. It was a while ago.
Yeah, when you look at it, you'll definitely realize, boy, that's bleach hair, Rob Bell.
Yeah, he hadn't gone off the deep end, so you can trust what he said back then for sure.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I think Brent said that tongue in cheek. He knows I'm a big Rob Bell fan.
Yeah.
All right. So let's see here. So let's just talk about love for a moment and part of the problem. There are three Hebrew words that can be used to talk about love, particularly romantic love. The first word for Hebrew love is rayach. Now, rayach, for those of us that say Shema, we say Shema at the beginning of every class. We talk about, at the very end, there's a line. Ve'ahavta rayacha kamocha. And that means what, Brent?
Love your neighbor as yourself.
Okay, love your neighbor as yourself. And the word for neighbor is?
Rayacha,
right? Rayacha is your neighbor. And so the word rayach and rayacha are connected in root. And this is a neighborly or a brotherly love. It's a love you would have for your neighbor or your brother. The word expresses a kind of familiarity. But when it's used in a romantic sense, raya is the poetic infatuation that a person experiences when they begin a new relationship, where they can't stop thinking about the other person. When I do this talk for weddings, I often say, it's the raya that says, no, you hang up the phone. No, you hang up the phone. No, you hang up. No, I love you more. No, it's that electric poetic infatuation that is raya. Now, the next word for love is ahava. Ahava is not raya. It's not poetic infatuation. Ahava is commitment, both romantically and not romantically. Ahava is a kind of love that says, I'm going to be here for you no matter what happens, no matter what comes around the corner, no matter how I feel. Like, Raya is all about my feelings. It's all about the electricity. Ahava is a love that it doesn't matter what my feelings are. It doesn't matter if the electricity is there. I'm going to be there for you no matter what. Now, it's interesting, side note, little PS here. When we were talking about Shema, we had, what was the last line, Brent?
Ve'ahavta.
All right. So the kind of love your neighbor as yourself. God doesn't ask us to raya arayacha, to brotherly, neighborly love my neighbor. God asks us to have ve'ahavta, ahava, ve'ahavta, rayacha kamocha, to love my neighbor with a committed kind of love that says to my neighbor, I'm going to be here for you no matter what. It's an interesting little side note. Now, romantically speaking, there's a third kind of love. So we have raya, which is the infatuation, she's my best friend, that kind of love. There's the ahava, which is hopefully what a marriage commitment would be about. The I'm going to be here through thick and thin till death do us part, good times and bad times, rich or poor. And then there's dode. Now, dode can mean uncle, but romantically speaking, when it's used as romantic love, dode is the sexual erotic love. Song of Songs will use the word dode, I believe twice, where it talks about kiss me with the kisses of your mouth, for your dode is sweeter than wine, I believe is the quote. She speaks of his erotic love, his sexual intimacy love, and she calls out for it. And so that's dode. Now, the point that Rob makes in the Numa video is very well taken, which is you as a human being, these loves, when we speak of romantic marital relationships, these loves are designed to work together. So the Numa is called Flame, because he speaks of every love as a flame. And by the time he gets done with the video, what does he do, Brent?
There's like a giant fire.
A gigantic bonfire. Yeah. Apparently you could see it from miles and miles away, I've been told.
You gotta see it.
It's impressive. And the illustration is, listen, you got Raya, and it's a flame, like a match, a lighter. And you got Ahava, and it's a match, and it's a lighter. And you got Dode, and it's a match, and it's a lighter. But the three are designed to work together. And when you put them together, you get this huge raging fire, which is the marital relationship as we read about it in Song of Songs. And the dysfunction happens in culture when we take one of those loves away. And so we might know people. We might have parents, or we might know others, or it might even be us, who is in a relationship where there's dode, and there's ahava, but raya left the building a long time ago, and it doesn't like... Now, raya always, by the way, important for college students that are listening, raya comes and goes. It's a natural part of our experience. There are definitely mornings. You've been married for a while, Brent. There are definitely mornings where we wake up and we're not exactly just charged full of poetry.
I'm almost never charged in poetry.
You don't say.
I'm not really known for my words.
Man, that sultry
Although
voice.
Although maybe to some of these podcast listeners, podrishioners, they might only know me through my voice, but not necessarily a big words person.
Yeah, so that's funny. That's a part of love that rages and dies. It's a fire that waxes and wanes. It has an ebb and a flow to it. That's why ahava is so important. But we all know those relationships that they're not even trying. There's not even an attempt at raya. And so the marriage is dysfunctional. Or maybe a marriage that has raya and there's ahava, but there's no dode, and something seems to be off and something seems to be missing. Or there might be relationships, of course, we have the dysfunction of our culture, which is we don't have the ahava. We have the raya and we have the dode, but no ahava. And that creates its own dysfunction. So these loves that are put within human sexuality are meant to be experienced together. So I have some closing notes and then a closing observation. When we speak of romantic relationships, we have to understand that God designed all three of those loves to work together simultaneously within a relationship. The struggle comes when we find one of those loves missing from the equation. In the college culture, it's very popular to engage in dode after experiencing brief rayah and not have any ahava. It's dysfunctional and destructive. Ancient biblical culture, if you remember our description of arranged marriages, so go back to like, think about ancient Eastern marriages. They start with ahava, they move into dode, and then hoped and worked for rayah. And if that wasn't accomplished, it too was dysfunctional and destructive. So it's not like there's a method here that's the right method, but they all approach it from a different angle, and they all have their particular challenges. We certainly have our challenges in their culture. And I find it interesting to imagine the biblical culture, which would start with ahava. Like, we look at that in our culture, we think it's, like, almost unethical. Like, how dare we start before there's any rayah, before we've learned if there's any chemistry? It's not necessarily a right or a wrong, but it certainly had its pros. I wouldn't necessarily say our approach is working very well in our culture today, as far as success rate. So many of our weddings in today's culture are bathed in rayah. It's about the music and the poetry, and she looks so pretty, and the music and the reception, and hey, photography, awesome. It's all about the rayah. It's all about the electricity. It's all about the emotion and the beauty and the poetry, but that's not what a marriage is supposed to be about. All those things, by the way, have their place. I hope so. You do a fantastic job taking wedding photos. And I want the bride to look beautiful on the wedding day. And I hope that there's a ton of fun. And I hope that there's wonderful dancing. But that's not what the wedding is about. The wedding is about ahava. And we've missed that. So we tell our kids to pursue relationships. We celebrate their rayah. And we tell them to prepare their relationships for ahava. But then we tell them to abstain from dode and wait and wait and wait and wait to get married until later. And then we wonder why our children fall, and we wonder why our sexuality is so dysfunctional. All three loves are made to work together. The Rabbi Paul spoke against this to the Corinthians, telling them that if their loins burned for one another, they were to get married. He told Timothy that those who tell people to abstain from marriage were engaging teaching from demons. The sexuality thing is serious stuff for the scriptures. Just one final observation kind of built off of that last paragraph of notes that I had there. And I'll talk more about this in our discussion groups when I can speak a little bit more freely. But we have a problem in our culture that nobody wants to admit. And that is for centuries and centuries and centuries, we recognize the biology of the human being. When the human being went through puberty, we got married in all ancient cultures because it was the obvious observation. Now, as culture progressed and evolved, and we started to get more and more educated, and we started to take things further and further and further, we started waiting later and later because of education, all in the name of progress. I'm not arguing that that was necessarily a problem in and of itself. I'm certainly not arguing we should go back to marrying off our kids at 13 or 14. I don't want to be that kind of a wacko. That's not necessarily my point at all. But as the world evolved, the church failed to address a new problem that came as a result. As we gave in to the Industrial Revolution and the Educational Revolution, and this gap of what we would call adolescence has gotten wider and wider and wider, we as the church have not acknowledged that we never stop to say, this is creating a sexual tension. God designed our bodies biologically to work in a particular way. We are now operating outside of that design. Not that it can't be done, but I just wish when I was growing up, I got to tell my listeners, I won't tell you too much. I failed in this area all throughout my adolescence. This was my area of greatest failure as a person, as a human being. It's the shame I carried with me for a lot of my life, was my failures in this area, growing up as an adolescent in particular, premarital. And I just wish somebody would have acknowledged the problem, because nobody ever did. Everybody just said, just don't do it. Sex is bad, don't do it. So let alone the dysfunction that instilled in me psychologically about what sex was. Nobody ever acknowledged the fact that this is actually really hard, and let me tell you why. It's hard because we may have, to go back to our conversation, Brent, on Chronicles, we may have given into some imperial idols. We may have made money and progress and production a little more important than we should be, and it may have taken a toll on our sexuality. And if somebody would have just been honest with me as a 16-year-old, as a 17-year-old, if somebody would have just been honest about the problem that we had created and then had a compelling reason why walking in the way of Jesus was a better way, and if somebody could have articulated kingdom of priests, but nobody did. Everybody just said, here's the moral code. Here's the do's, here's the don'ts. It didn't work. It's not working. It didn't work for me. It works for some. Bless the Lord. But it was a problem. It was a problem. And even as I sit here, I just want to say so much more. There's like an ocean of thoughts and an ocean of frustration and just passion behind. Golly, there's so much dysfunction. And this is something that we need to reclaim. We need to reclaim badly, or we're going to perish in the realm of sexuality. So Song of Songs reminds us that healthy, erotic sexuality within the context of marriage is beautiful, healthy, and to be celebrated. It is a part of God's design. We would do well to take heed of this enlightening teaching in the wisdom literature. There you have it, Mr. Billings.
There we have it. Well, if you live on the Palouse, we hope you join us for discussion groups. Moscow on Tuesday, Pullman on Wednesday. You'll get to hear Marty's half blog posts about the topic.
Half my series.
Half the series.
Half the series before I...
What happened to the other half?
Well, some of it I talked about in here.
Did you write them?
I did not write them.
I stopped writing them
because I wasn't sure my heart was staying in a good place. I don't know if I was getting angry. But a lot of the content we talked about in this podcast... and kind of unpacked there. So the stuff that I have written is more going deeper into some of the larger cultural systemic issues that I think we have, particularly in our particular conservative Christian context.
Sounds good. Join us and hear the rest of that story. And also maybe check out our Facebook page. Perhaps Marty will toss out a little nugget of Song of Songs information there.
Oh, I doubt it, but maybe. You never know.
Well, you never know.
You never know.
There's always good stuff on the Facebook page. And, of course, you can get a hold of Marty on Twitter at Marty Solomon. You can find me at EIBCB. And you can find more details about the show at BayMaDiscipleship.com. So thanks for joining us on the BayMaD Podcast. We'll talk to you again soon.